Welcome to Concordia Seminary's Focus on the 70s Latin American Culture and Mission Forum, the second in the series, one we conducted last night, another one tomorrow night. This evening, it is our pleasure to have with us one of our mission executives from our staff, 500 North Broadway. This is probably a gentleman who needs no introduction to a group like this here at Concordia Seminary. Pastor Fred Panko has been interested in Latin American missions for a long time. I remember even when we were students at the seminary here, he had a lot of interest in this area, and he served, for example, in Cuba way back in B.C., that is before Castro, and other places also. I don't even know enough geography of Hispanic America to be able to appreciate all the nooks and crannies in Central America, in the West Indies, and in South America into which he has traveled. And he is indeed a man of many parts. I understand from one of my friends down there that one time when he was introduced with this very colorful jacket like this, and somebody said, he's a man of many parts, and somebody quipped there, and I like the way he's put together. So we'll turn it over to Pastor Michael.
I didn't know what the proper liturgical color was for today, so I decided to play it safe and wear them all. This is from Guatemala. Cost, I think, $7, but it's quite comfortable. Thing is, the buttons are different from the way we use them. But I enjoy it anyway. I thought first I'll just give you an overview by means of pictures of Latin America, and then we'll talk a little about what some of this means. And so if we could have the lights off, we'll take a quick trip around Latin America through pictures. And you can enter Latin America anywhere along the border of Mexico. If you enter at Juarez, you have to slam on the brakes some places because the street suddenly may end. But we can reach Latin America either by land or sea or air. Of course, this is one of my buddies who will go along with us. This is another buddy I met down there. You know, sometimes they sleep in bed with you. You have to be careful. This is another one who is quite well known in Latin America. And we'll just take a quick look at some of the churches and some of the religious work which is going on in Latin America. This is the back of a Lutheran church in Mexico. This is another one in Mexico City. Most of our churches are small, and these are our workers in Mexico related to the Missouri Synod. There are actually 10 Lutheran groups in Mexico, the four major ones, and then others of an independent nature. But those related to Missouri have about a dozen pastors, and they take care of about 1,500 members. There are about 12,000 Lutherans in Mexico, served by people from Europe and the United States. This is a Lutheran seminary in Mexico City. Those are the students. And then moving into Guatemala, one of the things that's most striking in Central America is the volcanoes, which are, many of them are active. And these are our workers in Central America. Again, there are various Lutheran groups from Europe and the U.S., but there are about 20 Lutheran pastors related to the Missouri Synod in Central America. Of course, the dominant faith is the Roman Catholic Church, and Guatemalans have a beautiful scenery, as you know. This is Lake Atitlan. I went swimming here. It's a mile and a half high, I guess. Dr. Preuss of our synod was swimming in here someplace close by, too, over the Christmas holidays. I stayed in 2.5 hours because it was so delightful, and I came out looking like a broiled lobster, and I lost all my skin. They like flowers in Latin America, as you'll notice. And their architecture is Spanish-influenced, Romanesque, and Rococo or Baroque. Very beautiful churches. You'll notice the ladies in the foreground carrying water pitchers on their heads. This is a church in Chichicastenango in the highlands. Many of the people in the highlands never were fully converted, you might say. Shortage of priests and language barriers, cultural barriers and the like. And these Indians still maintain some of their former beliefs and practices. And the Roman Catholic Mass is held in the morning, but in the afternoon and evening, many Indians will worship also their former gods or goddesses. Very important in the life of people in Central America and the Andes areas is the religious processions, and we'll see a little more about that in a moment. They're very artistic, and this is one way in which they make their living, and then they carry it off to market. I couldn't carry one third of that, but they run up the mountains with this. And you'll notice the women like to carry things on their heads when they go to market. That's how they carry their goods. And every city has its own colors in the mountain areas, especially Guatemala. You can tell where a person's from by his dress. It takes about 3 weeks to make one of those by hand, one of those lengths of cloth. And they have their own version of the supermarket, too. The mothers feed the babies while they have the air-conditioned supermarket there, and just pull up in the car and point to what you want. I sent my shirts out to be washed, and it came back with tiny holes, and I realized then they use an RCA Whirlpool washing machine, you see here. They pound them on the rocks and rub them in the stream. And this is one of our cathedrals, open air. They just gather under a tree and hold their classes. This is the Lutheran Center in Guatemala. It has two wings going to the back and houses about 50 people. We use this for conferences, training sessions for clergy, lay people, and the like. This is our largest church in Central America, Christ the King in Guatemala City. And I still remember the first day I went in here, I said, nice, and it sounded like this. Nice, 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 nice. It was echoing off of those. But when there's people inside, of course, then you don't hear the echo. As I mentioned, processions are very important in the life of the people. You, of course, recognize this is St. Peter, and I forget which saint this is. This is a Madonna statue, another Madonna statue, very important in the religious life of the people. And this man feels very happy, I'm sure, that he is privileged to carry one of these statues, even though it seems to be pretty heavy. This is Tegucigalpa in Honduras. Most of the countries there are rather mountainous, and so the cities also are built along sides of the hills. And sometimes to get to them, you just drive right through the river. I was astonished when a bus headed for the river and went right in, and I thought we'd all sink. Then I realized there were rocks under the water that I didn't see, so I opened the door was open. I took the picture. This is one of our churches in El Salvador on the border, Pasaquina, made by the people themselves. This in Costa Rica, San Jose, pastored at that time by a Finn, the left. There, Tapani Ojasti, his father, had been a spy for the U.S. in Finland and was discovered, so the Russians wanted to poison the family. They succeeded in poisoning the wife, and his father and his brother learned of the plot to kill them, and they fled to Venezuela. And the father was hard of hearing, and a policeman told them to stop at a certain place when they were having elections. He didn't hear, so his father was killed by the policeman. He then became a pastor. This is a small congregation in Costa Rica. Most of our congregations are small. Here I'm operating the Panama Canal. This is Panama City, which is quite... that's backwards. This is a small Lutheran school in Panama City in a slum area. And these are what the superhighways look like in the backlands of Panama. This is an area where there was no church or school or community center. So our church decided to start work here of various kinds. And so this building is used as parsonage, doll factory, community center, training program for raising chickens, you name it. This is where I started my ministry. This is Havana, Cuba, as it was at that time, a beautiful city, kind of hot. The sun shines bright on my old Havana home. You'll notice some of the American signs that dominated life there, Packard cars in those days, cool cigarettes, hot point refrigerators, and so on. This was one of the chapels we started. We had services in German, English, and Spanish. And these are some Cubans that began attending our services. We put up pictures in frames representing biblical scenes. The one in the middle on top is Noah building the ark. We would preach on these each Sunday, a different picture, and then the people would explain to others that came what it was all about when they came. And this is how my wife and I used to look years ago. The Cuban people are very artistic, and this is a Christmas program in which there were 120 children participating, and everybody had an important task. One was the fourth helper, the third wise man, and so on. A small congregation in one of the areas of Havana. Now we move into other areas of Latin America. Our work is strongest in Brazil. Again, the Missouri Synod only has about like 20% of the Lutheran population. Most of the others are related to Europe. This is a Lutheran school, about 500 students in Brazil. We have about 165,000 members. This is one of the pastors, and this is quite typical of the kind of houses and chapels that we have in Brazil, in the outlying areas, tile roofs and frame or wood building. There are some stuccoed brick buildings. You'll notice the cars in Brazil are mainly Volkswagen, made in Brazil by the millions. This is an installation of a new pastor in a small congregation, of which there are about 1,100 related to the Missouri Synod. The new president of the Brazil district to the left is Johannes Gedrot. And this is the congregation as it departs. These are some church officials from the States to the right, Dr. Ed Weber to the left, Dr. Milton Carpenter speaking with the new president. This is a scene from the Brazil District Convention. This is a scene from the Argentine Convention. You'll notice the cars look a little different there. Something like lawnmowers with a tin can on top stuck together with chewing gum. This is the Argentine Convention in session. A missionary from Brazil, no, from Chile, speaking to them. And of course, one of the favorite pastimes is having asados or churrascos, which are barbecues, and they really enjoy that. And they have the musical portion afterwards. And since the water's not very good there and wine is cheaper than Coca-Cola, why drink wine or why drink water or Coke? So they all enjoy good Argentine wine. I remember asking a man at the restaurant whether it was made from grapes, and he said, you know, they can even make it from grapes. So I don't know what this particular wine was made from. It tasted quite good. This is the Christ at Rio de Janeiro, about 155 feet high. And this, of course, is what it's all about. This is the message we try to bring in Latin America, as do other churches, bring people to the Christ, the only hope for them, for time and eternity, as for us. Okay, that's it. If we could have the lights, please. Thank you. Maybe somebody wants to turn off the... Thank you. This is João and Maria. They are from Brazil. They would like to greet you tonight.
Boa noite.
Boa noite.
So they will be with us for the evening also. Many of the people in the Pampas in Brazil and Argentina make their living from cattle. And any good cowboy needs his equipment. One of them is the cuatro, which is a four-stringed guitar. And some of them are really amazing at the way they can play the four-stringed guitar. Very expert. They all need a well to let down the pail for water for the cattle and themselves. They all need a tea kettle for their tea, which is called mate, which is a bitter kind of tea but has a lot of kick to it. And I remember the first time I helped myself to a little bit too much of that, I had zip till about 3 a.m. and then the next day I wasn't worth anything. But it's a delicious tea once you get to know it. These are the bolos that they use to wrap around the legs of the cattle that they're trying to brand. They just throw it and it wraps around, and the critter falls down and they grab it and brand it. So that's a little bit of, by way of background. And this, you may recognize, is the llama from Peru and other mountainous areas, a combination beast of burden, a source of milk, cheese, source of cloth, or rather hides for keeping warm and the like. I passed out to you a few outlines, and before we look at them, I just want to give a quick overview then of the Lutheran population in Latin America. There are about 1 million Lutherans spread over the continent. And as we go down in Mexico, there are about 12,000. In Central America, about 5,000. There are 6 small Central American countries. And then in most of the other countries of Latin America, there aren't too many, usually like between 1,000 and 3,000 or 4,000. Venezuela, for example, has 3,500. But in Brazil is where we have the largest Lutheran population, about 900,000, of whom about 165,000 are related to the Missouri Synod. In Argentina is another rather large segment, say about 150,000, give or take 50. Some of them are just baptized and don't really become active members. It's sort of the remains of the Volkskirche in Germany. The Missouri Synod has about 25,000 in Argentina. The largest grouping is even the Evangelical Church of the River Plate, which has, they say, about 100,000. Actually,
Probably a correct figure would be 60,000. The other 40 are not too active.
There's a segment of Lutheranism in Chile of about 25,000,
again mainly related to Europe, Germany, and some few, up to 1,000, say, related to the Missouri Synod. And then in these other Andean countries, as you go up, there's anywhere from 500 to 1,500 or 2,000 Lutherans in the country. There are 45 Lutheran entities spread through Latin America, of which 5 are related to the Missouri Synod, and 40 are related either to Europe or to some other group in this country or are independent. But we try to coordinate our work in such a way that we don't duplicate too much, for example, in literature. Before we started coordinating, before we knew what the others were doing, we found out that 5 different churches had translated Luther's catechism into Spanish. So we had 5 different Lutheran catechisms, that type of thing. But now we're trying to coordinate our efforts so that we don't duplicate. Last night, I think you heard a little about some of the problems in Latin America of a social and economic nature. And I'd like to refer just briefly now to this outline on liberation theology. If you have that, if not, there's some other copies around. Whoever happens to have them, if they would see that they got passed around. I think Paul has some there. No? Are there some more on liberation theology there? There should be in one of the other folders. Okay? Part 1 talks about the problems of underdeveloped societies in which our churches work. The problems of Latin America are, first of all, historical. They just kind of grew that way. They were not... The countries were not formed like this country was. The Spaniards went to Latin America and searched for gold, as you know. They were not interested too much in agriculture, as were those who came to this country. The King of Spain would give large land holdings to his favorites. And so you have one big feudal chieftain, perhaps owning hundreds of thousands of acres of land. And this has been a problem with the life in Latin America to this day. For example, in Uruguay, there are vast extents of land, vast expanses that are not being used. They belong to some big landowner, and he figures he's got enough with what he's cultivating or grazing, so why bother with the rest? So they import food rather than till the soil. The problems are also political, as you are well aware, and their whole political system is quite different from ours. Their problems are social and religious. I think you heard something about that last night, so I won't spend too much time on that unless you wish to ask questions. Someone has described areas of Latin America as a powder keg. In certain countries this is the case. And so they try to find solutions to options offered for solution of these problems. For example, as I mentioned this morning, the U.S. gross national product per capita is $5,000 per year. In Bolivia, it's 180. In some of the other countries, it's like 230 or maybe even 350. And so we North Americans, comparatively, are wealthy. But Latins have large families, and they have to divide up the little they have with many mouths. So you have in Latin America
the gross national product is slowly increasing, but in the U.S. it has been growing like that, so that the gap between the U.S. and Latin America each year gets bigger. But another problem related to this, and maybe Dr. Millett talked to you a little about this last night, I don't know, maybe those lines are a little too abrupt, but goods and services available per capita in Latin America is declining because there's only so much food available, and it's not the food supply is not increasing rapidly enough, but the mouths to be fed are increasing more and more, so that you have less and less for more and more people. Whereas in the U.S. it has been going this way, there's more and more available to the people. Now, what do we do about this? Well, some say, let's stick with what we got. We made it from yesterday to today, and we'll probably make it from today till tomorrow. Let's support whatever system they have, military dictatorship, or some phase of democracy that isn't working. Others, B, say, well, let's gradually try to reform things. Let's break up these big land holdings little by little. The trouble is that the people, this isn't fast enough for the people. I remember being in Chile, and I talked to the president of the Christian Democratic Party, and I asked him, what are your two biggest problems here? He said, unionism and legalism. And I thought, aha, a good Missouri Lutheran. And then I asked him, what do you mean by unionism and legalism as your major problems? And he said, unionism, well, the labor unions have so much power, they control the country, and legalism, well, they think just because land was given to their ancestors 400 years ago, that therefore their descendants can have the land today. That's a law they think must be followed. Now, in distributing this land and dividing up the goods among the poor, it's just going too slowly for the people. C, some say, well, maybe we can get the U.S. to bail us out. And they've tried that in various countries, and it helps a little bit, but not enough. It's like putting a Band-Aid on cancer. D, violence. Some are saying the only way is to use force, throw out the North Americans, throw out their corrupt dictatorship, as they had in Cuba, they say, and put in our own system, as they did with Fidel Castro. E, this is the option that most thinking churchmen are going for, liberation, and we'll talk about it a little bit in just a moment. And F, well, some say you got to combine several of these in some fashion, for example, liberation with violence or whatever. Three elements of the theology of liberation. I think you may have heard a little about that last night. They want to use the social sciences to analyze their context. They want to use economy to see what's wrong with our system, and sociology, what's wrong with the way we are running our society, or history. How did we get to this horrible, grim situation that we're in? B, a broader understanding of salvation. They say if all you're going to preach about is there's a pie in the sky by and by, or suffer now, heaven is coming later, forget it. In most of Latin America, thinking people say that's not enough. The world is on fire there, and we can't settle the problems in many of these countries just by that kind of theology. C, seeing God in history and cooperating with Him. One of our clergymen, avant-garde you might say, says he's a confessional Lutheran theologian, but that we need more than that in Latin America today, and he's not sure just what his theology is going to do or going to be. He's going to be active where there is a need to be active, and then kind of reflect on it. Now let's see, what kind of theology was that? D,
political action, organizing people politically to improve the situation in their countries, and E, community organization. This is quite popular and quite effective in some areas, not in others. For example, there was a Lutheran Peace Corps worker and his wife went into a section of Venezuela and decided to organize a community so they could irrigate. And he got all kinds of things for them, pumps and aluminum pipe and the works. And they started a nice program of irrigated truck gardening. And he was there 3 years. The community was beautifully organized when he left. And after he departed, they said, now look, we got all this nice pipe and all these pumps here. Wonder how much we could get for it. So they sold it all and divided the money. Okay, conclusions. Can there be a Lutheran theology of liberation? There is an attempt at Lutheran theology of liberation, which I don't know if we'll have time to get into or not tonight. Let's see how you folks want to go at it. And that's just the gospel today in and for Latin America. It's 2 pages. Maybe you'll want to study it a little more at home. But this is an attempt to give a Lutheran theology of liberation. I have some trouble with a few items here. But they try to see how the situation in the Old Testament compares with the situation in Latin America today. There was political and social injustice, suffering, hunger, illness, of course, sin and eternal death. What did Jesus do when he was confronted with this? Well, D, he emphasized more than was expected the spiritual aspects, but he was also active in alleviating bodily ills. 3, what liberation do the people of Latin America expect? Well, they want more activity on the part of Christians in the political and social sphere, battle against injustice. They don't want the church to be identified with the wealthy, but rather with the needy. They want Christians to be identified with struggle against bodily ailments, hunger, and so on. But they also seek reconciliation with the eternal. And finally, 4, on page 2, how does the gospel meet the hopes of liberation of the people of Latin America? A, B, C, D, it denounces, well, now here I have a little trouble with the use of the gospel. Here I would say the Word of God denounces the symptoms of political oppression. It condemns injustice. It battles against hunger, sickness, and the like, and it announces reconciliation of humanity with God. D is where I would see gospel being emphasized, and the other 3, Word of God. Maybe I ought to stop talking now and let you see if you want to ask some questions at this point. I've been talking a little too much, I guess.
Who made this up?
This was made up by some professors in Mexico. Yes. As I say, they're talking from their standpoint, and we sitting in this nice, what is the temperature, about 70 here? Room, well-dressed. I just had a beautiful meal in a restaurant with Dr. Silflo and Professor Brighton. We comfortable Americans might say, yuck, you know, when we see something like this, but if we're living there as they have all their lives or served there all their lives, maybe we would be a little kinder to this sort of thing. Yes?
Well, last night's speaker stressed the significance that he saw in the church identifying itself with the poor. I think he implied rather clearly that the Lutheran church has not done this, that it's identified itself with the middle class. Would you care to comment? Would you agree, disagree?
No.
Also with his premise that it ought to identify itself with the poor.
Yes. Well, of course, we should identify with all groups, but in Latin America, you have a different kind of social structure than you have here. In Latin America, the social structure is
Here you have the wealthy,
5%.
Here you have the middle class,
which is, depending on the country, in Mexico it's as high as maybe 30%. In some other countries it's maybe 10%.
And here you have the masses. They're downtrodden, make 10 cents an hour or 25 cents a day, as they do in Guatemala. So this is the poor, which is
80% or whatever, depending on the country.
Whereas, of course, in the United States, you have, say, 10% low class, or 15 or 20, give or take. And mainly you have a middle class society,
70% or 60, however you want to figure it.
So that if we want to reach Latin America, this is where it's at, you might say.
And Lutherans generally have tried to identify with this element in Latin America,
with some exceptions. They do have some people identifying with the poor.
Okay. Was there a question over here? I think I saw, yes.
Yeah, I'd like to see a backup of those figures there. I would dispute, 10% poor in this country.
Well,
as a pastor of a ghetto area in Detroit, I would say it's much more than 10%.
Uh-huh.
But I was going to ask another question. You said that this theology of liberation was drawn up by some professors in South America.
That is the Lutheran version. But there are many theologies of liberation, and it started in the Roman Catholic Church in 1965.
Right. Now, my question is this. When we were faced with a conflict of how deeply we get involved in revolution, in liberation, and so forth 200 years ago, it was not the united opinion of the Lutheran Church. In fact, the elder Muhlenberg and his son had their very classic dispute concerning the place of the Lutheran Church involved in the so-called liberation of the colonies that formed the United States of America. Now, are we to assume that everybody among the Lutherans agrees basically with this theology, or is this reflecting perhaps one part of a thinking minority where another part of the thinking leadership would firmly disagree with it?
That's right, yeah. I think the latter is the case. I think probably there are more people in the lower class now than there were 10 years ago or 20. I don't know what figure you want to use, whether it's 20 million or 40 million or whatever in this country. Okay, was there another question over here somewhere? Yes.
I just might add to what the pastor was saying, that this theology of liberation is very much in dispute in the Roman Catholic Church also.
Yes.
It has many different versions, and it certainly is by no means accepted by many, even among the hierarchy.
Yes. In general, among Protestants, I suppose between 5 and 10% of the clergy are hep on this. And among Lutherans, maybe 4%. I don't know. Just a guess. Yes.
I noticed in the pictures that you had, in Central America, there did seem to be a large number of Latin Americans, but the pictures you had of Brazil and the Argentine, they didn't look like Latin Americans. They looked
yes.
like Europeans.
That's right.
Now, is this typical?
Yes.
Has the church in Brazil and the Argentine attempted to reach the Latin Americans?
Yes. I think more and more they are. Of course, they speak Portuguese now more than German or some other European language. And, of course, you have a stronger European element in South Brazil. What you have in some areas is heavy German. For example, in Blumenau, I understand they still speak German on the streets. When I was in New York, I was asked to take a service at a congregation that was German and English, and a Brazilian walked in, but he was black. And he had come from Blumenau, where he learned German and became a member of the Lutheran Church. And so a very nervous German-American usher walked up to him and said, Sir, this service is in German. And he said, Ja, ich weiß, darum bin ich gekommen. Okay. In Colombia, primarily in what they call the years of violence, North American missionaries perhaps went too far in pointing out what they consider the errors of the Roman Catholic Church. In some cases, they invited this kind of hostility. In some cases, it was present. In some cases, it was promoted. 200,000 people died in this struggle between the liberals and conservatives in Colombia, and the Protestants were considered liberals. And so this was also part of the political struggle. And in this also some Lutherans lost their lives. But this has generally subsided, and we have very good relations in many areas with the Roman Catholics, and I visited masses, and I remember one in Cuernavaca. There was a North American preaching in Spanish, and he spoke on, by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. And I sat all through the sermon saying, why isn't that man in the Missouri Synod? Or I was surprised at how close we were, and we walked up to him afterwards and thanked him for his excellent message. And so in many areas I think we're coming closer together. Okay? Yes?
In the light of this new tendency in liberation theology, what do you think is the challenge for, first of all, a theological seminary here in North America, and what are the options for North Americans who are prepared in theology or other dimensions for mission service in Latin America?
Mm-hmm. More and more, they see the role of expatriates as that of short-term specialists helping out for specific tasks, maybe in theological education. But you almost have to be brainwashed in the right sense to be effective down there. When I got to Cuba, maybe I told one or two of you this already, I got my car off the boat, and it was just about lunchtime. I decided to pick up some groceries, and I drove from one grocery store to another, and they were all locked up. So I parked my car, and I started walking around trying to find an open store, and I became so angry at those stupid Cubans that would lock up their store in the middle of the day. And after half an hour of walking in that sun, I got such a splitting headache, I almost fainted, and then I realized I was stupid. And this is a sample of how I think we have to become brainwashed to see that the way they do it may be the right way in their situation. And it takes a while to learn this. I think it took me about 3 years to become Cubanized, and then I think I became more effective. Okay? Yes?
Is it possible for us to steer clear of all these political maneuvers in order to continue and to progress in the Word of God?
Yes.
Our experience here in this country, I believe, is in that respect.
Yes. As pastors, I don't think clergy should identify with this or that political party. But the membership somehow perhaps should be active in some area, whether it's political or labor union or what have you, so that you have a Christian input and a Christian influence. Okay? Yes?
Do said that this outline of liberation theology for the Lutherans came from Lutherans in Mexico. Has this remained with them primarily an academic interest, or is it being implemented in some way in their work in the church?
Well, it's a study document that they are asking people to look at, and I didn't give you Appendix B because I was somewhat critical of it, and I wanted you to have your own reactions. But there is an Appendix B to this, which I'm going to give to our mission board, but I won't let you see that because I'd sooner let you react yourselves. But I think in their situation, they're trying to plug into where the people are. Maybe I can just tell a quick story I may have mentioned again to one or you or the other of you. When I first got to Cuba, I decided the right way to do church work is go house to house and knock on the doors and tell them we're going to have a Lutheran service in 3 months. And you all come. And I visited 2,000 homes with my wife and said, you all come. And they said, yeah, we'll all come. And I thought to myself, gee, the whole works is coming. Where are we going to put these people? So I rented several hundred chairs, and I said, the rest is just going to have to stand in the street. Well, nobody came. And then I realized afterwards there was no reason why they thought they should come, because the impression they had of Lutherans was not favorable or was rather unknown. And so I tried to see what are these people really worried about, and there were three things. One was sewers. They had open sewers, and the kids would play in the human dirt that would float by. The streets were a horrible mess, and when it would rain, the women would go out in their nylon stockings, they'd take off the shoes, and they'd go down this deep in the mud sometimes, and they needed a drainage ditch to drain off the water when it rained. So drainage ditch, sewers, and streets, that's what they were interested in. They weren't interested in Lutherans. So then we said, well, why don't we get together and do something about this? And they said, well, we can't do anything. And I said, why don't we all give $5 a month for a year and let's see what happens. So we got quite a number interested, and we had $14,000 after 1 year. And then we went to the newspapers to tell them our plans to try to help fix streets, sewage, and drainage ditch. And the politicians read about this. So then we went to see the mayor. Oh, yeah, I read about that in paper. We said, well, what can you do? He said, well, I'll match you, $14,000. So we had $28,000. Then we went to the Minister of Public Works, and he said, well, you can use my machinery. You can use some of my asphalt. I'll lend you some men to show you how to work. And we went to the President of the country, Batista, and so on. Well, after 2 years, we had a drainage ditch, sewers, and streets. And gradually, these people started floating into church. They wanted to see what kind of message that fella preaches that's out there sweeping the streets with us, getting them ready for asphalt. And so gradually they were drawn in that way. Maybe that was the wrong way, but it worked for me. Okay? Yes?
It seems to me that the way you go about it would be somewhat of this approach, that you identify with people and then they ask, what message do you have to help us see? And once you, but the message is not in your work there helping
that's
them
right. That's right.
The streets and get a drainage ditch. The message is Jesus Christ that you're going to bring to them when they come. Mm-hmm. It seems to me this is where the problem with liberation theology lies. That it identifies God as working out there. Mm-hmm. Well, God out there is really the God of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, unless I know Him through Jesus Christ. If I don't know Him through Jesus Christ, He's my judge, not my Savior.
Okay.
And it seems to me that's where liberation theology, identifying God as working out there, creates more of a problem than it solves.
Okay. Very good comment. Any other questions? I think we have about 5 minutes. Yes.
How concerned are we as a Lutheran church down in South America in helping our people identify with the problem and deal with it? Something what you were saying, you know, in seeing the problems and getting involved in solving them, not as a not liberating them from a problem, but expressing our Christian faith and our concern for the needs of other Christians. Isn't that what James said? If your faith without works is dead, if you don't, if you see a problem, you don't do anything about it. And John says, or if you say to your brother hungry, and you say, well, that's great, James, that's great, find some food, and we don't do anything about it, we're just fooling ourselves. What does the church do in South America?
It depends.
Lay people getting involved.
In some areas, they're doing very well. For example, in rural Panama, they use the church building for bringing people together at all hours for whatever purpose. For example, to introduce a new kind of chicken that will withstand disease and lay an egg a day, and show them how to prepare food for chickens made out of termites and things like that, and they grind this all together. There's plenty of termites around. And the people gradually are taking an interest in the message of the church also because of that concern. But in most areas, I guess we've been very traditional and said, well, church, that's something you do in a building for 1 hour. And we haven't always applied it to life. Now, maybe Rudy would like to comment. Rudy Zimmer from Brazil knows the situation in Brazil better than any of us here, I'm sure. Do you want to comment on that, Rudy?
I would say that the Brazil district is trying to do something else now, especially last year, and was a very traditional all the almost 70 years that it exists. And so we are still German church almost. But now that they speak the language and they are concerned, are going to another way of approach. We have to change a lot, I think.
There is a...
Even in the church, in the church services and so on, because that's not our type of liturgy and so on, we have to change some because that's not working.
Should use this more instead of the organ, eh? In some of the areas. Guitar. Yes. Okay?
Don't you feel that there's a real danger, though, in reducing liberation theology to a method, you know, like we have on a sheet like this? Whereas in an individual situation where you see it working, then it's a lot better than on paper.
Right. So this is just a study document to kind of get people mad.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it did to me at first, and gradually said, well, maybe they got something there too, you know. If I lived there all my life, I might talk differently. Okay. Yes?
Can't this thing be interpreted as an aspect of our sanctification, that God works in us, and that it need not be contrary to the gospel message of Jesus Christ, but rather telling us, well, look, we have more of our sanctification than our own inner spiritual growth. We have what you found, the roads and the gutters and the dirt and the filth or whatever else happens to bother these people in their social life, they'll be a bad government or bad roads.
Yes. Absolutely. Okay, yes.
Aren't we coming very close to the idea of watering down our Christianity to the level of easiness, and so in time it would just float away? Maybe it is hard work, and haven't been there myself, but the trend today is watering it down and just keeping the true Christ in the center.
Uh-huh. Well, that's always a danger, of course. I think you have to do both. As the Germans say, das eine tun und das andere nicht lassen. Do one, but don't omit the other. I guess it depends on the person, too. Yes?
I think your comments concerning A, B, and C under Roman numeral 4 are very good. I would add to that the same criticism you made there to the first sentence under final reflection. I think the one of the basic weaknesses of the document, as I see it, is a mixture of law and gospel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I renounce injustice, that's not the gospel. That's the law.
Yes.
And as one who was involved in certain integration and marches and so forth of nonviolent height in the 60s, I think we kept that very clear, that when any Christians participated in that, that was not the gospel of Christ. That was a form of the use of the law, but not the gospel. And I think that should be very strongly clarified in the paper.
Now, this paper somewhere says, in its broadest sense, the gospel. Yes, in the preamble under part four in the middle, in its broadest sense, the gospel message denounces. In other words, with gospel there, they want to take the whole counsel of God, the whole scriptures, I think. Sometimes you see it gospel used that way in some of our writings.
I think it's a very unwise use, if I may express my personal opinion.
Yes, I think it can be confusing. Does that about do it, or do you think, I gave you another paper on topics which can be discussed. I don't know if there are any questions on there anybody's interested in, but some of this I imagine you got last night already.